From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. The Conservative Party won a sweeping election victory in Britain with an apparent majority. In Scotland, the Nationalist Party, which favors independence, won 56 of 59 parliamentary seats. Meanwhile, an attack by two Islamic State sympathizers was foiled in Texas, and FBI Director James Comey said the terrorist group is making recruitment overtures to hundreds, maybe thousands, of people across America. Meanwhile, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said she would expand President Obama's amnesty for illegal immigrants if she's elected president in 2016, while polls showed her reputation has suffered from her connection with the Clinton Foundation. Well, David, I'm glad you're here, because we certainly want to discuss this surprising outcome in the British election. How in the world did the Tories win? Every poll showed they'd have to settle for another coalition government. What happened?
Well, the simple explanation may well be that people were a bit shy about admitting that they were planning to vote Conservative, because the Conservatives are, you know, often called the nasty party. They Right. tend to be for cutting things and being less generous with welfare payments, and they did get a tiny, narrow majority, but they were not expected to get anywhere near a majority. Now, why should people around the rest of the world care about what is my home island, but it is just one island off the coast of Europe? Here's why you should care. So at the moment, the United Kingdom is England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, four countries joined together firmly as one country, and they're members of the European Union. What happened makes that very, very unstable. I think the chances of, in 10 years' time, there being a United Kingdom with those same countries in it as a full member of the European Union, the chances of that have gone down dramatically. Scotland voted in a referendum to reject independence and to stay part of the UK last year, but then those same voters turned around and, as you say, essentially turned Scotland into a one-party state, 56 out of 59 seats for the Scottish Nationalists, and their leader, who will be their leader in London, turned around and immediately said that the Conservative Party have no legitimacy in Scotland as a result of this election. We've also seen David Cameron making a speech accepting his victory and announcing what he'll do next. The very beginning of his speech in London on Friday morning was to say, you will get the referendum that you were promised by me on whether we should leave or stay in the European Union. So gigantic shifts sort of set up now.
Barbara, what do you make of this? I mean, England is the country that the U.S. always falls back on in a pinch. What about it? The Conservative Party seems to me won partly because the economy there has improved.
Yeah, the economy has improved. I think we have to realize that even though they're called the Conservative Party, they preside over a society that has much more socialistic features in it than the United States does. I mean, many people in the United States would, you know, only dream about having a government healthcare system that is not as difficult and complicated as Obamacare, as what we have gotten here now. You know, National Health Service is much maligned, but there is healthcare for everyone in Britain. Education is not as outrageously as expensive in Britain as it is in the United States if you want to go to a good university, things like that. So Conservative, yeah, in relative terms, but still, you know, a very mainstream party in international terms. It is disturbing that Scotland is now a one-party state, pretty much. But on the other hand, isn't that sort of, David, a cheap and easy way of showing your desire for independence without actually taking that step? I mean, independence was defeated in a referendum not long ago. So, you know, it seems to me this is just a way of showing nationalist feelings without necessarily meaning they're going to leave the United Kingdom.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. I mean, I thought the Nationalist Party in Scotland is unequivocal about the one thing they're interested in is independence.
They are, but they've been very smart in the last few years, and their rise has basically been as a result of taking a strategic decision to make themselves kind of this left-wing utopian kind of party. And essentially, I think what we've seen is this election, if you want to try and understand this complicated election with moving parts, is in Scotland on the left of politics and in England on the right of politics, you have seen voters seeking to reject some sort of other, the other, who is somehow making everything wrong. So in Scotland, it has been extremely potent to say, we could have a kind of socialist utopia with very high public spending and, you know, lots of free stuff, if only the wicked English could be sort of pushed back across our borders, because they're the ones mm-hmm. stopping this from happening. In England, it has been very potent to say, we could have a much more prosperous country and things that people want, like high pensions and the NHS and lower taxes, if we left the European Union, kicked all the foreign immigrants out. And you saw in England a really substantial vote. If you add the Conservatives to the votes given to this right-wing populist anti-immigrant, anti-Europe party, UKIP, they got, you know, 55% of the vote between them. So one of the oddities of this election is we do still have a very old-fashioned voting system, the same as the US voting system, where you have one member of parliament for each place and the first person across the line gets everything. It's winner takes all. But in fact, if we had had a European-style voting system where, you know, parties, you look at their overall percentage of the vote, their share of the vote, and allocate parties' seats that way, you would have seen some very small fringe parties doing mm-hmm. extremely well. I mean, a lot of the fringe parties on the right and the left came second in a lot of constituencies. So you'd have seen a ton of members from the populist extreme parties.
But David, the Independence Party only got one seat and its leader lost.
Sure, but they came second in 118 seats out of nowhere. And that's gigantic. I mean, they probably, I haven't seen the final numbers, but they probably got 10% of the vote.
That doesn't sound so gigantic to me, since they lost all those seats.
No, because if you lived in a European continental country, they would have had 10% of the seats in Parliament.
I know, but that's it doesn't have the same
sure.
system.
Sure, so the voting system has kind of applied the brakes to the political momentum, this sort of sea change. If you can apply brakes to sea change, which I suspect you can't, it would get very wet. But moving aside from my horrendous mixed metaphor, there are very, very large changes underway, which I personally don't think are very well thought out. There's a lot to do with kind of people just wanting to wave a magic wand and imagining if you can kick out the horrid English from Scotland, if you can get England out of the European Union, then somehow things will be magically better. And I worry very much that this is fantasy politics.
All right, time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie. And David, the polls in England were pretty consistent, and they were pretty consistently wrong. What happened there? I mean, you mentioned that there may be some shy Tories, but, I mean, this is a big failure.
It is. And if you're interested in the validity of opinion polls, let's not forget that there were gigantic differences with the opinion polls in America in 2012, mm-hmm. where in a slightly different direction. So in that case, you had Republicans saying that the opinion polls were understating the Conservative vote, and it turned out that they were completely wrong. Part of it does seem to be this strange phenomenon of what they call shy Tories. So these are people who are planning to vote Conservative but are a bit embarrassed about it, so they just lie. I think all pollsters will also tell you that it's getting harder and harder to get people to answer the phone and spend 10 minutes answering their questions. Part of this is fewer and fewer people have hard landlines into their house. They're all on mobile phones. People are busy. They tend to screen their calls. And if you actually talk to the big companies that do opinion polling about the percentage of the people that they contact who actually answer their questions, it's really tiny. It's like single-figure percentages. Mm-hmm. And then they have to put in all their secret sauce and their magic modeling to try and turn that into a representative sample. And I think it's slightly breaking down.
Hey, Barbara, what does this election mean, if anything, in particular, to American foreign policy? Mm-hmm. When I think of Cameron and the Brits, they have certainly supported Obama on the Iran deal. But are there any tensions here?
I don't think so, really. Whether it was Tony Blair or David Cameron, I mean, the relationship between U.S. government, or whether it's George W. Bush or Barack Obama, I think that this relationship endures. Britain has always been pretty much the closest and best partner to the United States in on one issue after another. There was a period when it looked as though the French under Sarkozy would somehow supplant the British, but that passed, and now we have François Hollande sometimes tacking left and sometimes tacking right, depending on the issue. So I think it is a true special relationship.
David Cameron has promised a referendum in England on staying in the European Union. I think his strategy, correct me if I'm wrong, is that I'm going to negotiate with the European Union to get much nicer terms, mm-hmm. and if we have a referendum, well, it will say stay in. Is that realistic?
Well, here's the problem, is that, you know, his advisors are privately telling him that they've been to Paris and Berlin and Madrid and Rome and Brussels, and they've been told, you know, we will give you a bit, but we won't be held to ransom by Britain. We would like Britain to stay, but not at any cost. So I think David Cameron is very aware privately that there are, you know, pretty serious limits to what he can get out of the EU. Because remember, we're one out of 28 countries, and they don't want to be held to ransom by the UK. Mm-hmm. The problem is that his voters have very unrealistic expectations as to what he can achieve. Just to touch on Barbara's point about the special relationship, I think in terms of Britain's kind of instincts, those remain as close to America as ever. So last night I was at the British Embassy, and in their garden they have at the moment a special exhibition of the ship's bell with huge holes gouged out of it by a German bomb attack, which was on a warship in 1941, which was bombed by the Nazis. And one of the officers on that ship was the current British ambassador's father. And they had the Joint Chiefs of Staff over for a party, and this bell was placed there by the Royal mm-hmm. Navy as a temporary loan. You know, the symbolism is all there. The problem is, that's our intentions and our will. But are we actually going to spend the money to run the modern warships, mm-hmm. to build the aircraft carriers, to maintain the weapons that we need? And here's a final point. If Scotland is determined to seek a separate path, which we don't know yet, but if Scotland leaves, that is a very serious problem, not just for the UK, but for the Americans too, because Scotland has these very deep seawater locks, these kind of deep, deep granite lakes, bays, sort of inlets like fjords on the side of Scotland. They are the only place in the entire United Kingdom that you can park a nuclear submarine. That's where Britain's nuclear submarine deterrent mm-hmm. is based. And they are such fantastic places to park a nuclear submarine that the US Navy uses them too, because they're very deep, they're mm-hmm. sheltered by mountains, and you can sail straight out underwater mm-hmm. Into the deep ocean without being detected by the Russians or whatever. So take away Scotland, and Britain's nuclear deterrent actually has nowhere to park. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a sort of ridiculous idea, mm-hmm. but actually it's a really serious problem.
Well, you're making me worry. Yeah, Barbara, in the United States, we don't really see much of David Cameron. Americans don't follow the international news a lot unless Americans are involved. But what is David Cameron's reputation as a world leader? He has struck me as, unlike the French presidents and so on, as someone who's gotten along better with President Obama than almost anyone else.
I don't know if that's they certainly do seem to have a reasonable relationship. They're close in age and so on, and temperament. He hasn't made a huge impression, I would have to say, on most Americans. He's not slick and flamboyant like Tony Blair. And of course, the times have changed, and the United States is involved in conflicts, but not massive wars as they were a decade ago, where Britain's role was really important. So, you know, I'm glad the British like him. I'm not sure most Americans even know who he is.
Do they really like him?
One of the interesting things you hear from American and British officials who have watched President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron in the same room several times is, if these people were not president and prime minister, they would never be friends. You know, I mean, you know, David Cameron is an old-fashioned English kind of aristocrat mm-hmm. type. You know, Barack Obama is a Chicago community activist. But David Cameron is a very shrewd reader of people. He read very early on that one of the problems of being Barack Obama is that a lot of world leaders are emotionally very kind of high maintenance around him. They all wanted to be his best friend. They wanted, you know, as much time with him as they possibly could. Someone told me an amazing story. The first time they had an official meeting in Washington, they went through the agenda. At the end of the meeting, David Cameron said to President Obama, "Well, we've finished the agenda and we seem to have finished early. If you're anything like me, you never get spare time in your schedule, so take it. Let's just finish the meeting early." Mm-hmm. And that was just the most brilliant thing to do, because no one ever says that to Barack Obama. Everyone always wants to have more and more and more of him. So being kind of very low maintenance, which has been David Cameron's shtick with him, has actually been quite effective.
Well, they never. Bill Clinton always wanted to continue the meeting.
Yeah, having said that, does that mean that David Cameron is phoned before someone like the German Chancellor when they really need to get something done? No. At the moment, If you're America and you need to get something done in Europe, you call Germany first.
Yeah, sure. Well, that'll probably continue. An amazing election. Let's turn to this foil terrorist attack in Dallas, where two were killed. But I was more struck by something. The head of the FBI, that's the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the national police, in effect, in the United States, who said, and I'll quote what he said, that there are, quote, hundreds, maybe thousands, unquote, of people across the country who are receiving recruitment overtures from the terrorist group Islamic State. What about that, Barbara?
That doesn't surprise me at all. In fact, I would think it's tens of thousands or even more. You know, if you're on social media, if you're on Twitter, and you express certain views in a certain way, you are out there, and you will rapidly attract attention, sometimes from people you would rather not attract attention from. And you can certainly block trolls of various sorts that have offensive things to say about you or offensive suggestions to make. But if you're a young person who is alienated and perhaps interested in what's going on in terms of the Islamic State and all the fighting in the Middle East, you might be more receptive to at least listening to their point of view. And if you look at this particular case in Texas, these were two individuals who were from Arizona, actually, and one of them, Elton Simpson, was a convert, and he had been in touch on Twitter with a British fighter, Junaid Hussein, who goes by the name of Abu Hussein al-Britani, and a Somali-American now in Somalia who uses the name Mujahid Miski. And these gentlemen, particularly the British guy, had called on American jihadists to follow the example of those who attacked the premises of the Charlie Hebdo magazine in France and killed people in the Jewish deli in France back in January. So you could call this kind of Twitter recruitment.
I mean, there's an optimistic and a pessimistic way to look at what happened in Texas. The pessimistic way is, you know, this is exactly what we feared would happen. And let's also be clear. This Texas attack was deliberately provoked by people on the far right who set out to create a provocation. They had a Muhammad drawing competition. These are people who have a history of, you know, very incendiary anti-Muslim remarks, and they got exactly what they wanted, which was, you know, they set out to provoke and they provoked. I think if you're going to be optimistic, it is worrying that people are in effect self-radicalizing, which is a phrase that counterterrorism people use. At the moment, that's still better than in Europe, where people are actually actively one-on-one radicalized in kind of inner city mosques full of people who have personally come back from the fight in various jihadist kind of campaigns. So if people are having to be contacted over the internet and over Twitter from afar and then kind of invited to sort of self-radicalize, that in some sense is less scary than the stuff that's happening in sort of inner city Europe, where people are actually in their own communities meeting jihadists.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, it was a botched attack. Yeah. The two attackers were killed. And there's no indication that the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or any group had anything to do with organizing it.
Yeah, I think they claimed it, but they claim everything.
Of course.
So anyway, time for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie, and we're going to get to Hillary Clinton, but I wanted to ask you something first, Barbara. I know on VE Day, Victory in Europe Day in World War II, you were invited to the Russian embassy and went. What was it like?
Yeah, well, I was also invited by the European Union, so, you know, and
I
went
trying to typecast you now.
And I actually went to both. Here, you can't put this on the air, but there's a picture of me. It was interesting. You know, the Russians lost over 20 million people in World War II. Almost half the casualties of the entire conflict were Russian. Mm-hmm. And that was partly because of Stalin and his incredible brutality and stupidity and purges and disorganization and all the rest. But nevertheless, I mean, if you are of Russian origin connected in any way to this, you remember those who died. And the Russians claim they saved Europe, you know, and there's something to that. I mean, without the Russians, the Nazis certainly would have done a lot better, and it would have been much more difficult to defeat them without those two fronts. So it was interesting. You know, the Russian embassy in Washington is this very Soviet-era building with giant crystal chandeliers and very high ceilings. It makes you feel very small. But it was full of people. The food was excellent. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people there, particularly Americans of Russian origin, who I think felt a need to go and pay their respects on this date and to recognize the contribution that Russia did make in the war.
Okay, David, let's talk a little bit here about Hillary Clinton. She's obviously running for president in 2016. She's also somewhat beset by a couple of scandals, one involving the Clinton Foundation, which has taken a lot of money from some foreign governments and foreigners. And also there's this, still this thing about her deleting emails and so on. What do you make of the whole thing with Hillary Clinton? Polls have been mixed. Some show that she's, one of them shows that only 25% of Americans think she's honest. Another poll shows that it's much higher than that, more favorable to her.
Well, it's very early days, but I think what you're seeing is, I mean, if you do the mathematics, just simply look at the mathematics, whoever the next Democratic nominee is, and it's, you know, clearly overwhelmingly likely to be Hillary Clinton, she has to win as many of Barack Obama's voters as possible. And if there are some of Barack Obama's voters who she cannot win, because, for example, blacks, they turned out in unbelievably gigantic numbers for Barack Obama because he was the first African-American president. If she doesn't do quite as well at exciting inner-city African-Americans, she's going to need to replace those missing Obama voters with some of her own. And so, you know, I have no doubt that we'll see things like appeals to, say, married women, which was rather a difficult group for Barack Obama. He's very successful with unmarried women, less success with married women. But Hispanics, they are still kind of the next electorate. They don't vote in gigantic numbers yet. They're already a large number of people, but actually only half of them who could have voted did vote last time round. But this immigration position she's taken out is essentially, you know, the most pro-Hispanic-friendly immigration position you can take, not just let those who are here illegally have a green card and live here legally, give them a clear pathway to citizenship. And it's quite clear that what she's trying to do is to outflank all of the Republicans, no matter what their views are on immigration, to be still more immigrant-friendly.
Well, she's outflanked President Obama.
She's outflanked President Obama. We will see her do this, I suspect, on several issues. I predict she will run to the right of Barack Obama on foreign policy, on several issues. She will run to the left of Barack Obama on economic policy on several issues and immigration.
Well, I'm waiting for her to run to the right on any, but anyway, Barbara?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I think also given that Marco Rubio, who is of Cuban origin, appears to be the flavor of the month for the Republican Party, it makes good sense for her to distinguish herself also from Marco Rubio, who's very tough on immigration now that, you know, he is here and his family got here, but forget about the poor masses who have come since and who don't come from Cuba. So I think it's very wise. We've also seen her, as David said, stake out a rather leftist position on economic issues, also on racial disparities and policing in this country. She gave a very, very moving speech after the killing in Baltimore, the latest one, about the essentially two worlds that now exist, you know, between poor blacks and everybody else in the United States in terms of education and unemployment and life expectancy. So she's proving to be a more interesting candidate, frankly, than I thought she would be.
Has she overcome, David, the effect of these scandals? I mean, she is clearly not going to talk about them, take questions on them, but reporters seem to have moved on.
Well, we need to be clear. There isn't a kind of definitive scandal yet. What there is a kind of sense that, as ever with the Clintons, you know, you give them a rule and they will kind of bend it and twist it and manage not quite to break it. But, you know, there isn't a scandal. No one has actually found a direct kind of what they call, you know, smoking gun, linking some money coming in here and that leading to a government decision here. That hasn't happened.
Pretty close.
I don't even think that's, we can disagree about the details of that. I'm not saying that there aren't scandals in there. You know, President Clinton, Bill Clinton, has made over $100 million since leaving the White House, delivering speeches, receiving all kinds of money from very rich companies and people. Who knows what's, you know, in there in terms of influence peddling. But there isn't a definitive kind of scandal yet. What there is a lot of kind of exhausting, wearying noise. And I think that in itself is dangerous for Hillary Clinton because she's not the freshest kind of proposition on the marketplace. She's not the newest story in town. And if there's kind of an exhausting cloud of kind of, well, you say this, but I say that, and you can't prove this, and here's my rebuttal, I think that could just exhaust a lot of people, and that's not great for her.
Well, she does lead in polls there a year before the election year, but she does lead all Republicans in polls. And before we close, I want to ask you one thing. In the beginning, David, I said an apparent majority for the Conservative Party in England. Have they got it?
As far as we can tell, yeah, they've got a very, very narrow majority, yes.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.